Hello and welcome to Next on WQLN. I'm your host, Marcus Atkinson. We're here talking today with another one of our favorite guests, Dr. Paris Baker. Dr. Baker, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we wanted to just kind of unpack the whole situation in Tennessee. You know, it's interesting that ever since we've seen or witnessed the rise of Donald Trump and these Trumpian tactics in the Republican Party, it has been both fascinating and sad just to see the decline of some of the tactics that they've used since this persona has really landed on the public landscape. And I know oftentimes I've called myself a Republicrat. That's been my favorite term for years. The Republic part has been very difficult in the last handful of years,
right,
because it is just taking a very, very dark path that I think that they will regret dearly in the near future. And this episode in Tennessee is one of those chapters that I think they'll look back and say, you know what, that was an overreach, it was a misfire. What were your thoughts when you saw how this whole thing played out in Tennessee with these legislators?
Well, first, the legislation came because of the issue of the shooting, so I don't want to lose that. You know, when you have three children, 9 years of age in elementary school, the unthinkable happens, and you should be caught up in some emotion that requires you to speak to those issues, and not forgetting the three adults who were killed also. So that was some of the impetus for them speaking out. And I think that's important to lay the foundation and the motivation for really their voice. And their voice was incredible, 27 years of age, and articulating common sense points. I mean, there was nothing radical about what they were saying. Let's just do what's right. That being said, this is not new. And it's way before Trump, okay? The professor, Derek Bell, I think said it best. So if you look across history, all the way back to Reconstruction, the advancement of black folks has always been met with a pushback such that when there's an advancement, again, primarily white men tend to push back to a degree that prior to the achievement or the accomplishment, black people are either at the same spot or in a different spot that is worse. For example, Reconstruction brought on Jim Crow, black codes, Ku Klux Klan. Okay, and we had to deal with that for, you know, 100 years or so. So it's not new. I think I've always said Donald Trump just unlocked the door to America.
Absolutely.
Just unlocked the door.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're seeing is, and unfortunately, I wish we would grab that point that this is our America. It is, with all its uglies, it's a beautiful nation, but we got an ugly history, and we should embrace that. You know, from my substance abuse brothers and sisters, you can't deal with the problem until you admit you have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so America has been somewhat resistant in doing that.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's really a sad situation. You're absolutely right when you think about why they came together in the first place.
Right.
With these shootings, you know, one of the things, the march was called the March for Our Lives, the student-led gun reform group. One of the chants that they said over and over again that I thought was spot on: you ban books, you ban drag, kids are still in body bags.
Mm.
And I know that there is this culture war going on in this country, but in terms of prioritizing, these students are challenging the sensibilities of these legislators. Like, where's the priority at? Personally, and I'll let you chime in on this personally, I used to always say that when a child was murdered because of the senseless gun violence, that we would hit rock bottom. Mm-hmm. I'm like, that'll be it when that happens. And the first time it happened on a mass scale, I said, oh man, this is about to turn the whole thing upside down on its head.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't.
Right.
And then it happened again.
Right.
And it happened again and again and again. And at this point, it's, you know, we're saying to ourselves, if the most vulnerable, the most valuable asset of this country is this accessible, can be gunned down, and everyone's like, I won't say okay with it, but there's no hardcore action. What does that say? And you say this is America. In a lot of ways, this is one of those sides of America where people tend to bury their heads in the sand.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as you listen to these young people, give us your thoughts on some of the things that they're saying, just the activism that you see going forth, because this really is what America's supposed to be about.
Right.
that freedom of expression and freedom of protest. Talk about that.
This is Generation Z, and I love it that they have an incredibly strong voice. But again, I'm going to go back to this is our America. Unfortunately, we have not valued children. We don't value old people. The most vulnerable are the most vulnerable in the United States. And again, I'm not bashing America, but if you think about, you know, why do we have child labor laws? It's because we were dogging children for a long time, putting them in the most dangerous positions, you know, because they had small hands. We're going to allow them to put their hand in a machine that could cut their hand off for a dollar. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, the Bible says that you can't save God and mammon. And it is the spirit of mammon, or this idea of wealth, that supersedes how we take care of the most vulnerable. And that's just been, again, at different times with different groups, but went through a lot of different groups. We have not valued those. I think it was Gandhi who said, you can judge the greatness of a nation by how it takes care of its most vulnerable citizens. Mm-hmm. And again, we're doing a good job now, but that's not part of our history. Mm-hmm. So back to the Gen Zs, the voice, you can't mention Tennessee and not think of Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. And at that point he was 30, well, he died when he was 39, but I think it was in 63 when he was in Alabama. And he went there to, there was an issue with the bombings, I believe. And, you know, he was at that point, he was, what, 34, 35, mm-hmm. maybe. And it's always been young people, as far as I'm concerned, in the movement, the Freedom Riders, mm-hmm. and those kind of things, where there's something about the innocence of children recognizing what's good and what's bad, mm-hmm. and being able to speak to that. Now, that's kind of crazy because they have the least information, but they have the greatest energy. And so when we look at these young people, you know, and what was that quote? I want to get there. What'd you say was you ban?
Oh, you ban books, you ban drag. We've got kids in body bags.
You know, that rhyme, it speaks volumes to a population that is saying, if we don't like what you're doing, we're gonna silence you. Wow. And this generation saying, and we're just not gonna be silent, not on these issues. What I find strange about Tennessee, it's his history, which is rooted in racism. You know, you got the development of the Klan in Tennessee. And, you know, you would think at some point, we wanna step out of that and develop a new persona for our state. But that doesn't seem to be the character of the state at this point in time anyway.
Mm-hmm. You know, to go with your point about you don't do what we want you to do, or if you are not compliant, then, you know, you'll be dealt with.
Yeah.
In 2020, the Republican legislature in Tennessee passed a law. It's passed a criminal justice reform bill that, among other things, makes it a felony, mm-hmm. to pitch a tent outside the Capitol overnight, punishable by up to 6 years in prison.
Right.
And so this goes hand in hand with exactly what you talked about.
Yeah. If you think about the culture of indentured servitude or slavery or whatever, however you want to frame that, we want to control the minds and the bodies of people. And if we can't control you by intimidation or retribution, we'll just physically control you. And so one of those ways is to develop rules that can imprison you or kick you out of the state or don't allow you to come into the state. It's kind of like that. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Mm-hmm. And here we are going through the same nonsense again.
I'm going to read this paragraph from the New Yorker because this goes into the supermajority the Republicans have right now. And this paragraph actually has that sentence that I just read about that criminal justice reform. Mm-hmm. The paragraph says, in a crucial way, mm-hmm. the outcome of the April 6 expulsion vote was preordained in 2010. That year, Republican lawmakers used the redistricting provision that follows every census to gerrymander the state in such a way that it packed Democrats into a smaller number of districts. Not surprisingly, the election of 2012 delivered the Republicans their supermajority in both houses of legislature, which essentially gives them the power to do as they please, such as expelling duly elected legislators. And then it goes on. So it talks about just that majority. And again, you unpack the background of Tennessee, and it looked at cities like Memphis and Knoxville and some of these larger cities that have large pockets of Democrat-leaning voters.
Right.
And what they're trying to do is, when you look at the future of Tennessee, for all intents and purposes, you know, it may be pretty blue when it's all said and done. But as of right now, you look at what's going on in Tennessee, the NRA is something that people point at regularly in terms of who has more influence, the NRA or what's going on. Mm-hmm. Now, some of the politicians involved with this are heavily NRA sponsored. So in response to the shooting, it says Senator Marsha Blackburn, who's received more than $1 million from the NRA, along with the state's junior legislator, Senator Bill Hagerty, who received about $16,000 proposed federal legislation to create a $9 million grant program that in part could be used to turn and train veterans and former law enforcement officers into school security guards. What are your thoughts on that proposed legislation?
We're going to make schools prison, military zones. You can't have education in that kind of environment. And that kind of environment has always worked against black and brown students. So I would not be for that. Here's an interesting thing about what you just read. As a social scientist, what we're taught first is observation, study the problem, know the problem. And then what makes sense as an intervention? It should come out of our observation. And I'm just perplexed that of all the solutions like the ones you read, the one that we have not tried is, let's just ban those weapons of mass destruction. The AUR, whatever it is, 15, I don't shoot, I don't have anything to do with guns, okay? But we have not tried it, so we don't know if it works. And I'm just perplexed as, why have we not ever tried that for a year? Interesting, if you go outside the United States, guess who's tried it? Japan and Norway, and it has worked.
Right.
It has worked everywhere, but the United States, because we haven't tried. And I got the answer. I'm not perplexed, like I don't get it. But what is preventing us or stopping us from even considering an idea? And I go back to, there are two things, and I'm not beating up on my white brothers, because it's not every white brother in America. It's white men with money and positions of power that can orchestrate policy that benefits them. This is not a white boy issue. It's white men with money who are saying, you know, the dollar supersedes the care of our children.
Right.
And I think it needs to be said that way, because we go back, for me, I go back as a starting point, we go further than Sandy Hook, 2012, I think, or 2010. You said, how many times does that have to happen? It's going to keep happening.
Obviously.
Yeah, until we make a definitive statement to say our children are really important, and let's do whatever is necessary, in the words of Malcolm X, whatever is necessary to protect our children. Mm. And you have not heard that on the other side. I would love to hear NRA. Get a little passionate about this, but I would love to hear a representative from the NRA stand up and say, this is what we're going to do. I think that would benefit the organization if they were to say that, you know, in response to what's going on, we're going to lose some revenue to make sure that we're taking care of kids, greater gun safety, because that's what NRA was for. It was teaching people how to safely operate guns. And then it morphed into something else, okay, what it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they need to return back to some of those precepts, some of those principles. And man, what a statement. What a statement if representatives of the NRA said, you know, we're gonna have a council, or we're gonna have a convention or a conference, and we're gonna bring all the folks in, tell us what we should do. And then they do it.
Right.
Oh, that would be crazy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I talked about 2 years ago how Governor Lee out of Tennessee pushed NRA-sponsored legislation to allow most people over 21 to carry a handgun in public without a permit. And now the Tennessee House is poised to lower that age to 18. So they're going further down this rabbit hole that you're talking about, this counterproductive. Gloria Johnson, Justin Jones, Justin Pearson, the Tennessee Three, as they're being called.
Right.
Obviously, the two Justins were expelled. Mm-hmm. Gloria Johnson was not.
Right.
Unpack that for us.
Well, some of it's just obvious. Okay, two black men, one black woman, 27 years of age and 60. And so I don't know if there was any age issue in there, but clearly it was a racial thing. Now, when I was listening to the news, the commentary was that she was she remained in her position by one vote. And I think it might have been the sequencing of votes where one of the brothers who had not been expelled voted for her, and that was the vote that kept her in. We don't know. I don't know. But they're back, and I love that.
Right.
The very people put them out forgot that they could be put right back in, and mm-hmm. so I think it's going to work against them in that fashion. But again, I go back to them young brothers who said, whether I'm here in the office, in the legislature, you cannot silence my voice. You cannot silence justice. You can't stop a movement, okay? And so the energy by which they're defending those issues is amazing. What I would hope, and here's my concern, you know, that platform was orchestrated by the expulsion. So they were forced into a national light, and they're using that platform incredibly well.
Going in next, yep. Yeah.
However, that will pass. In a couple of months, it'll be old news. But the issue will still remain, and I'm really hoping that the energy that is being galvanized now remains. I think clearly they say we have the energy, we're not going to stop fighting. I believe them, but you need to have a group of people, like-minded people pushing forward to mm-hmm. make it happen.
Jones and Pearson were both activists in Tennessee. They have been going head-to-head with their same right. colleagues right now before they were elected.
Yeah.
And some of that kind of played into this whole drama that we see playing out in front of us, because now here you are among us mm-hmm. making laws with us. That unto itself was a problem. But I think about just the way that this is in some ways blown up in their faces
right.
for the Republicans, because you gave them a national platform mm-hmm. by doing what you did.
Absolutely.
Now you've got, you know, former President Barack Obama chiming in, all these other people chiming in. You've got Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, who raised nearly $500,000 for their reelection campaigns. Mm-hmm. This reminds me of, you look at the Black Panthers, mm-hmm. right? And people forget that it was the assassination of Malcolm X that led yes. to the rise mm-hmm. of the Black Panthers. And so you call yourself stomping out one problem, mm-hmm. it gave rise to a whole other problem. You look at the issues that the government and the state had with Angela Davis as an activist. Angela Davis was a member of that church. Four little girls were mm-hmm. in when they were killed, and it was bombed.
Right.
And so one problem always plants a seed, and so here you fell into that trap again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you gave them a national platform indirectly, and here we are.
The thing about the platform, and I go back to, for me, it's always like using game theory so that people can visualize the abstraction of policy. If you play the game Jenga, it's an interesting game because the game always ends with the tower falling. Okay, so the game is designed to fail.
Right.
That is the nature of the game. Okay. Okay. But here is what most people don't understand about that game. How do you win? And most people say when it falls down, I said, that's not how the game ends, but that's not how you win. And it's in the policy. And that's why I challenge people. Think about the game. You read the instructions. So if Paris and Marcus are playing, if we have a third person, it makes sense. But it works the same way if it's just you and me. So I move my piece, right? Put it up successfully, right? The only way I can win is if Marcus knocks it down next. If Marcus doesn't knock it down, it goes to the third person, I can't win. It's the person who successfully does it. The next person has to knock it down.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way I can win. So now, after I do it successfully, what's my motivation? Marcus, I want you to fail. I want you to fail so I can win.
Right.
Does it make sense?
Yeah.
So while we're doing all this stuff in policy making to change something, there are some groups that are saying, it's my turn. You know what I want to happen? I've made this advancement, now I need you to fail.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Think about mental health, which we talk about as a major issue, but how do you access mental health services? You can't just walk to a mental health services. You usually have to have a secondary problem. Like, if you come in and say, you know, I'm feeling depressed or whatever, it's going to take you through 2, 3, 4, 5 months to mm-hmm. access that service. But if you commit a crime, you go to the head of the line.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this is something that if you are, especially if you vote Republican on a regular basis, I would think and I would hope that you are watching all of the stark contradictions playing out in front of your face. And you're shaking your head and going into your circle saying, we got to rein this in. You had people comparing this. You had some of the legislators in Tennessee comparing this to January 6th.
Yeah.
I'm like, now, wait a minute.
Not
you expelled two African-American legislators because they were out of pocket for representing their, you know, thousands of constituents.
Right.
You didn't move with this kind of expediency against legislators who supported people overturning or rushing the Capitol violently. Are you serious?
Or more to the point, having a member of Congress walking past the group with their hand
with the power fist up.
Let's go get them.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And a former president at the time, the president, I'm going to walk with you and we're going to do what we need to do.
Right.
Come on.
Right.
That there was so much evidence as to how that happened and why it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the positive tip, you have two African-American representatives of their constituency, but not only just their constituency, represent a larger group across America to say we need to have, you know, common sense gun control, gun safety laws. And you want to expel them. Again, I go back to, is it an issue of safety or is it an issue of revenue? And that seems to be the revenue seems to be winning now.
Excellent point. Yeah. When you look at January 6th, I know they analyzed the text messages of Jenny Thomas, Justice Clarence Thomas's wife. And obviously there was a heavy slant. She was in communication with many people in Trump's orbit.
Mm-hmm.
And her views and her values where this whole situation was concerned were laid bare. People could obviously see what page she was on. And so it begged the question, well, where's, you know, Justice Thomas at where this is concerned. Now you have Justice Thomas accepting a lavish vacation from a billion-dollar donor, valued at about $500,000, you know, undisclosed.
Right.
And then you look at what they call the Trump appointees when it comes to pro-life stances.
Right.
We're at a moment in history where even the branch of government that we all hope and pray is bipartisan looks anything but at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And so as someone who studies these issues, you know, and thinks about them deeply, in your opinion, where are we going with all of this? Mm-hmm. Because right now, it feels like to a person, to a party, everything is us versus them. There is no middle ground or bipartisan ground. At least it feels like it to me.
Yeah, yeah. And to some degree, I follow right behind you. I agree with you. There is a level of morality that's either eroding or what I call mobile morality. It moves and it can move with the person. So what is ethical standard for you doesn't apply to me. And if you think about Clarence Thomas and respectfully Justice, Supreme Court Justice Thomas. I hope that changes, but anyway. To be in a position where nobody is checking him ethically, not only him, but any of them, is setting groundwork for being unethical. Like, how long will you allow me to do whatever I'm doing and no one's checking me? So, I mean, he did that with impunity for 20 years. He was doing this thing this time. Fortunately, someone caught him. And like, but if you think about how long he's been doing it, I've been doing this since I've been here, okay? To not be checked is, you know, that whole idea of corruption. But I want to introduce this term. Here's where I think we're going as a nation. There's a term that was developed by Killey, and I'll spell his name, M-B-M-E-B-E-D-B-E, it's an African name. He developed a framework called necropolitics or death politics. And he developed that as a time looking at apartheid in Africa. But I think that applies to what's going on in America, because the policy decisions that we're making are really life and death policy making situations. And if we're not careful, we're going to continue to make policies that lead people, whether it's reproductive rights, life or death situations, or gun control, life or death situations, or how we take care of the elderly and Social Security. If you think about all the kind of major issues that are out there, these are becoming life and death decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And we have people who are looking at with a lens of morality that may not be grounded in how you and I think about what's moral and ethical. This is what's good for me or my self-interest group. And so these kind of politics, it's important to see them as life and death. By the way, the other side is the biopolitics or life politics. It's important to see that because sometimes it takes years, sometimes it takes decades to unpack what has been in place. And so, you know, if you're elected for 4 years or 6 years, you may not have time to unpack and get that stuff straight.
Exactly.
You know, and so we could be going down. And again, I think about America. We've kind of been on a slow grade heading that way. This stuff didn't just happen. But we have been kind of just as a nation in some areas just eroding in how we look and think and treat mm-hmm. our people. It's
encapsulate to the best of your ability what you are hearing from students in your classrooms about these topics, because I know that this generation, many people say that this generation and the generation of the 60s bear a lot of similarities, which is why in many ways some of these young bucks and their grandparents mm-hmm. see many things the same.
Exactly.
Right? What are you hearing in general from that next generation, being someone who educates them every day?
Well, to be honest, I've been on sabbatical this semester, so I haven't talked to a whole lot of students this semester. But I do know their heart. I stay in touch with a few. And just in general, just talking to, again, Generation Z, which I embrace. And I do that primarily for spiritual reasons, because it says the young have the energy and the old, we have to show them the way. And so I recognize my time is kind of passing. I need to, who do I want to plant this stuff into and help them with the, you know, the fight that is going on now. There is a bimodal distribution of thinking. There are some young folks who they have, unfortunately, their own set of problems that are consuming their energies. And they should think about how I'm going to take care of me and my family, whether I'm a young family or, you know, what I'm going to do in college or whatever I'm doing. That's on my plate, that's enough. I can't deal with this other stuff. But you have another group who are saying, there are some changes that we have to make, because if I don't engage in these problems, they recognize this issue will be with me 10, 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And so I have to deal with this issue. I go back to Dr. King, and I don't know if a lot of people, this is kind of, I think, capitalize it. When Dr. King was going to Memphis, Tennessee, mm-hmm. the question was, why are you going, Dr. King? You know they're trying to kill you there. They don't like you there. And he said, well, I'm going for the sanitation workers. Mm-hmm. But he flipped the question. He said, you're focused on me. What would happen to me if I go? The real issue is, what would happen to them if I don't go? I have to go. I'm compelled to go. The love of people and the issue is greater than me. And he recognized, we know, the night before he was assassinated, he was eulogizing himself. But that, to me, that said, this issue is even greater than me. And so I'm willing to do the self-sacrificing. Now, I'm not saying that young people should, you know, throw their life away for this cause, because you don't know when that's going to happen. But I do know there are a lot of folks who are saying, I will, and for me it makes sense, I'm going to dedicate my life. That doesn't mean I'm going to die, but dedicate my life, my energies, my intellect, my time to change this issue. And those individuals, we have to get behind and support, because they will be the change that we see if we get behind and push them and help support them.
So the more things change, the more they stay the same, as you pointed out, rightfully so. You've got Senator Ron DeSantis, or Governor Ron DeSantis, who is doing his best Trump impersonation mm-hmm. while trying to compete against Trump.
Right.
Trump going through everything he's going through with this indictment, love it or hate it, whether you agree with it or don't agree with it, he's going through it and campaigning through it.
Yeah.
Is there even a possibility of that party hitting the reset button with all of these active forces still at play?
That is a great question. It gets to what I would like to say like this. I don't know if it's possible, but I do know that folks like DeSantis, who has the bravado that I'm a strong person, is really a weak individual, and I'm using position and power to mask myself, because he has not gone head up with Trump at all, and he won't, okay? Very few of the candidates will go head up with Trump because they're just afraid. And Trump himself, to me, is a weak individual, okay? We need folks with backbone not wishbone. And that, now I'm speaking to me and you and anybody else. If we allow politicians to fix this problem, we're in trouble. And that's the two young men in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot leave it to the powers that be, because we already see what they're doing. We have to take this issue by the reins, and we have to drive it. We have to make this happen, okay? And that's going to take folks with some backbone, because there will be some pushback, okay? That's just part of the process. So I'm ready for that resistance. Don't give up. Keep pushing. Keep pushing. So I don't know what's going to happen to the DeSantis. And by the way, there's a DeSantis now in like 10 other states. These governors, they think they're their own kingdom. Their state is their kingdom. We can do what I want to do, you know? That's okay. Your tenure is 4 years, 6 years, whatever. We're going to change that. And if there is enough momentum, just in terms of like physics, the force and the power behind these movements, my God, we will see an incredible change. I hope that we do that. I'm not focused on those governors. I'm focused on my energy and who's trying to make the change. And that's where we need to address our energies, I believe.
Now that the two Justins, as we close, now that the two Justins have been reinstated, what do you think this does to the momentum of the movement that they originally set out to embody in the first place, this gun legislation? Right. What do you think it does for that now that their voices have been restored in an official capacity?
Well, their voices are resonating, and I wouldn't be surprised. I would not be surprised. I mean, those young men, they sound sometimes like Barack or Dr. King, whatever. I mean, they're just elevated. I mean, I love to listen to them. What I believe is going to happen is the following. Folk, America, like we have, there's more guns in America than there are people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So are we going to get rid of guns? I don't think. We love guns. We do. Guns, guts, God, or something like that. Yeah. We got guns. The issue is not getting rid of the guns. It's getting rid of the assault weapon and making it more difficult for folks to get that, get access to those kind of things. Where I think we need to go is, let's get outside, and I'm pausing because I don't want to use anyone's name, but in Pennsylvania, in Erie County, who are those people? Because I can get behind Tennessee, but that's kind of too far away from me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's so many things I don't know about what's going on, but I do know what's going on in Erie. And shameless plug, because you know I like to do that. That's why the 100 Black Men is so important. We are so close to those young people by shaping how they think and what they do, for them to enter into those avenues
mm-hmm.
to make those changes. That's exciting.
It really is.
It is incredibly exciting. And if you think about, you know, if you a quick study on the history of those two young men, they were disciples of John Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they were doing that in college. I mean, they didn't just rise up. They grew up in an environment mm-hmm. where social responsibility and being an agent of change, they grew up understanding this is social responsibility, mm-hmm. that's mine. And so we have an opportunity, whether it's in Tennessee, but for us, for you and me, to do that in Erie County now, man, that's where it should be. That's what we're talking about. I get excited about stuff like that because that's kind of our responsibility at this point in our lives. Yeah.
Dr. Paris Baker, thank you so much for coming on to the show and talking about this tragic situation in Tennessee. And it's just a reflection of where we are as America. And ultimately, we know we can do better and we should do better. You're listening to Next on WQLN with Marcus Atkinson. And today we want to start a new segment called Who Are You? And one of the things that dawned on me quite some time ago is the fact that I have access to a lot of the individuals that you people normally either read about in the newspaper or you watch on the news. And so I figured, you know who these people are occupationally, but who are they personally? So I wanted to unpack that for you and bring you different people that you can kind of get introduced to and see them in a different light, kind of for who they are versus who we portray them as in the media or who we think they are. And so today, the first person of this series is Mr. Charles Boo Haggerty. Boo, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marcus. It's great to be here.
All right. Well, first of all, let me ask you this. unpack how you got the nickname, because I know a lot of people, they only know you as Boo.
Yeah, Boo is a nickname from when I was 6 years old. It's a long story, but I'll make it very short. Youngest of five boys, when I was 6 years old, I accidentally set our house on fire. And good news is no one hurt. Bad news is we lost a lot of our possessions.
Oh, no.
And in the midst of that, my brother, who I shared a room with, my brother Sean, his teddy bear went up in flames. And yeah. That teddy bear was everything to him. And he was not happy. He knew I did it. It was electrical in nature. We won't get into how the fire started. But he beat the living daylights out of me when he heard that. And I cried. And from the time I was six, they started calling me Boo Hoo.
Oh.
The youngest of five boys, were 6 years apart. And
wow.
Then the Boo Hoo was the nickname. And I don't, Marcus, how the Hoo dropped and the Boo stuck, and I'm Boo at 6 years old, I don't know. This is one of those nicknames that stuck, but it started because of that.
Excellent, excellent. And listen, I've always been intrigued by this because I'm thinking to myself, how much pull and influence does this dude have that he has corporate titans calling him Boo? And they're
it's on my business card. I can prove it's yeah, but Charles, my God-given name, but Boo is what everyone knows me as.
Funny, yeah. Funny. And so the Hagerty Event Center. Mm-hmm. Who was that named for, and how did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, that was an interesting story. So I had a brother who worked at Cathedral Prep for about 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle, Monsignor John Hagerty, mm-hmm. was the headmaster at Cathedral Prep for, you know, a number of years, but also taught there. And in his 60 years in the clergy, Cathedral Prep was really, really important to him.
Got it.
My mom was a teacher 30 years at Villa Maria. And at the time where Villa Maria and Cathedral Prep were becoming one, there was a donor who knew the history of our family. The donor, and I don't even know who this donor is, but there was a donor who had the naming rights to the building, didn't want it in their own name, and wanted it dedicated to a family that was really loyal to the school. And researched a bunch of families and chose ours. So, so really, it's. But I, you know, between, you know, my sons are fourth generation. My daughter was fourth generation at Villa, and I think the long history they had. My grandfather was in the, you know, was in the founding class, and this person had seen the history of my grandfather. My grandfather was city treasurer of Erie for 40 years.
Get out of here.
C. Francis Hagerty. Yeah,
okay.
He, from 1936 to 1976, he was the city treasurer. And I think that this donor had also seen that history, that my grandfather, you know, truth be told, in a time in the 70s where economies were tight and my parents had five kids and my cousins were, you know, all high school age at the time,
mm-hmm.
our parents could not afford to send us to mm-hmm. Cathedral Prep. My grandfather sent us there. So we were very fortunate that way to have someone who cared enough for us to have that education. So again, this donor saw the history of our family and decided to name it after our family, which mm-hmm. we were really honored and thrilled and, quite frankly, really surprised.
Got it. So let me ask you this. Occupationally, what are you best known for right now? Most people know you as what?
I would say most people know me as an administrator at Hammett. Most people know my career as being healthcare at Hammett, and then further deepening in it, how important it is to me that people in the community really understand what our mission is at Hammett.
So let's talk about your high school experience.
Sure.
Jock, nerd, cool kid, loner.
It's in the middle of all that. I was not a loner, but I was not the cool kid. So I'm somewhere in the middle. You know, Marcus, it's a great story. In 1977, I got a letter in the mail from the president of the Alumni Association.
Okay.
And he had asked me as a student leader to come to a meeting between the Alumni Association and the students. Well, I did not see myself in 1977 as a leader. As a matter of fact, I thought the furthest thing I was a leader, but I was in some student government club, so I was invited to this meeting. This man really was pretty inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
I still have the letter that he sent in 1977 calling me a leader, and I asked him at the meeting, after the meeting, why you sent it to me, and he says, you were identified by the faculty as someone who could be a leader in the school.
Okay.
And that changed how I viewed myself. So I got a little more confident. The letter, by the way, is from Tom Ridge.
Get out of here.
And I had Tom re-sign it a few years ago. So I kept that letter all the way because it one of those things that kind of change your life. So I, high school, middle of the pack.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. That's a good story. Favorite movie?
Oh, my gosh. So I love, oh, gosh, favorite. You're going to make me pick a favorite?
Choose one of your best. I got a couple, but just one of your favorite movies.
It's probably Remember the Titans.
Remember the Titans.
Yeah.
And give me the scene from that movie that stands out to you.
The scene from that movie that stands out is when Julius and the other guy, Gary Bertier, got in a fight at Gettysburg.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really about race relations.
Yeah, it was.
You know, and they got in a fight because one guy didn't think the other guy was working hard enough in practice. And watching the unity of those two in that scene in the movie. I just thought it was a great movie. I bet I watched that movie 15 times.
Mm-hmm. You know? When I look at the theme, you're right. That's a lot about race relations and people coming together. When I think about that movie and I look at what's going on in community and the fact that you are oftentimes in the middle of these very same discussions, what's the connection there? Is there something in your past that kind of lends itself to making you somewhat of a bridge builder? Because that's kind of your calling card.
Yeah, there is something in my past, for sure. I was an infant, Marcus.
Mm-hmm.
My mom had 5 boys in 6 years. We were living down on Poplar Street. My dad traveled for his work, and my mom got deathly ill and ended up being in the hospital with a really bad virus that she was sick. And the only person, my grandparents were out of town, so there's 5 kids under 6. Mom's in the hospital, dad's traveling, can't get back. And someone knew somebody to call a woman by the name of Lulu Crosby. And Lulu lived down down on the foot of Myrtle Street. And Lulu came to our house. Lulu was a black woman from Mississippi who was a maid in Mississippi and somehow got to Erie.
Yeah.
Friend of a friend of a friend. And this Lulu came to our house. She spent the next 10 years helping out our family when we needed help. And she was one of the most remarkable women I ever met in my life. She had 3 kids, she had grandkids. She was brave, she was strong. And she told me as a 6, 7, 8-year-old kid about the Deep South and the struggles that she had. And she really had a profound impact on my life. So I learned, and my mom, as the years went by, we'd see Lulu up until the day she died. We'd go down on holidays. We could just go down on the weekend and just visit and say hi. We'd have her come up to the house. Mm-hmm. And it was so hard for her. We invited her to my parents' 50th wedding anniversary party. And she came in her white dress and a black apron. We said, Lulu, we invited you as our guest, not to work. And she couldn't do it. And I had this conversation with her now as a teenager, saying, she goes, I just don't feel right being in the same room with all of you. I feel okay being in the back, but I don't feel right being in the same room. And I knew right then and there we had massive problems in our country.
Hardwired.
In our community. So, that's kind of one of the reasons I'm so committed to making sure that we bridge a lot of gaps.
Yeah. Strangest thing that's ever happened to you in a meeting, because I know you've sat in a lot of meetings.
Oh my gosh, strange.
Without exposing anybody.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I would probably say it was when a guy stood up and walked out of the room during the meeting. I was presenting something, and he got up and walked out of the room because he said I offended him. And I offended him by telling what I thought was the truth about he wanted me to write a marketing plan. I had an advertising agency.
Okay.
And he stood up and he walked out and he went to my car and tried to vandalize it.
What?
He was so mad at me, tried to vandalize my car. When I say tried to, he was going to key it, but I don't think he really knew how to key a car. Yeah. And I went out in the parking lot and I said, what are you doing? goes, I'm so mad at you. And I said, I'm just telling you what I think is, you know, my reality of what you're doing with it. So there was a guy who was going to vandalize my car because he didn't like what I said. That was pretty strange. I'm sure as we go along, I'm going to think of another one because I've been in a lot of strange meetings.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
You would rather win an Olympic medal or a Nobel Prize, and why?
Olympic medal, only because even in my best world, I can't imagine ever being in a world of winning a Nobel Prize. Not that I can ever win an Olympic medal either. Maybe like an Olympic medal for jarts or something. Maybe
right.
That's a really good question. I'm going with Olympic medal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Best book or article that you've read so far in 2023.
So I just read a really great article on a housing first model. We're working on what a housing first model can look like in Erie and how we can best address homelessness. Mm-hmm. And this article is written in The New Yorker. And it talked about the fact that a basic human right is that every human being needs a place to live, mm-hmm. needs a home. And if we don't look at that as a human right, like everything else is, we'll never curb this homeless population that we have. And so it was an article in The New Yorker. I don't even know who the author was, but it was a really incredible read on giving us a new perspective of the homeless population. Homeless people are looked at as drug users, mental health offenders, mm-hmm. Criminal offenders, when in fact they weren't that before they became homeless.
Right.
They became homeless for a different reason. And then if you don't have a place, like you don't have a place to live. And the other thing it talked about was sleep deprivation. Imagine what you and I would be like right now, Marcus, if you and I in the last week only had 2 or 3 hours of night sleep.
That is so profound, because as you're saying that, I'm thinking to myself, that is a prisoner of war tactic to try to break prisoners.
It's Geneva Convention stuff.
Right.
It absolutely is.
And so if it's that effective to break people in war,
yeah,
I'm assuming it has the same effect on people. That is an excellent point.
It absolutely does. And it's in this article went on to say it's scientifically proved.
Wow.
Yeah. So to get everybody in our country a place to live would solve a lot of problems.
Favorite song? Life has a soundtrack. What's your favorite song?
Oh my God, you're killing me now. I wish I could have prepped for this. I know why you didn't let me prep.
What are your favorite songs? It had to be the.
God, Let It Be.
And what does that remind you of?
Well, you know, Paul McCartney and John Lennon were prolific. Mm-hmm. What these guys wrote about. Mm-hmm. But just those three words.
Yeah.
You know, like there's certain things you have to accept. But then also the song says you don't have to accept everything, you know? Right. So Let It Be. That has some pretty deep meaning. But then The Way You Look Tonight, Frank Sinatra, it's what I danced to with my wife on our, you know.
Nice.
So just, you know, that's kind of like that romantic song. Dance. You didn't ask me for two. I'm giving you two.
That's all right. Listen, this is your time. So we're always sharing memes and videos, and we're inundated with it, right? Mm-hmm. Social media, people email you stuff. Give me the meme or the video that somebody sent you or you got a glimpse of that actually caught your attention. It made you laugh. It made you mad. It made you cry. Just one that really grabbed you.
Okay, this one's political, and just this weekend. And it was actually really funny. It was the cold opening to Saturday Night Live this weekend, and it was Jesus at the Last Supper. And it was interrupted by Donald Trump, who was comparing his trial coming up to the trial that Jesus went through. It was so bad and so funny at the same time. So political humor kind of cracks me up, because somebody needs to call some of these people out for what they are, which is absolute fraud.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that was pretty funny. I like to laugh, Marcus. So anything someone sends me that's got a little comedy or a little humor, a little bit to it.
Yeah.
You know, I like that.
Saturday Night Live takes no prisoners, man. Everybody gets it from Saturday Live, man.
No one is innocent.
I don't care who you are.
50 some years. I remember, Marcus, no kidding, I watched the very first Saturday Night Live in 1976.
Yeah.
Yeah. 11:30 live NBC. I remember I remember watching it.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
1976.
Yeah.
This one's kind of an academic question. With everything that you do right now, what class did you take in college that actually comes in handy in your everyday life right now?
Yeah, that's a really good one. I would say two. One was the sociology class. That was fabulous. This teacher was incredible. And it was really basically telling college kids, you're in a world right now where everyone looks like you, but when you graduate, you're going to be in a world where everyone's different than you. You know, it's so funny in college.
Mm-hmm.
You're around people who are just like you. You step out that next month, that next year, whatever, and you're in a brand new world, depending on what you do.
Yeah.
So that sociology class was interesting. I took it because I had to, and that was really good. But probably my 400-level advertising class that I took, because I had a professor. 1984 is the year I took the class that predicted the internet, the World Wide Web, and where, like, was telling us what our world was going to look like in advertising 10, 15, 30 years. The World Wide Web didn't come out to the 90s.
Right. This is 84, he's saying this?
84.
Wow.
And he was this older guy, and we thought he was a little crazy, but he was spot on. He's like, you'll be able to go on a computer, a laptop computer, which didn't exist. Like, a laptop computer was like having, like, you know, a Mercedes Benz, you know, like, you just didn't have them. He said, you go on your laptop computer, you will order anything you want, and for the most part, it could be delivered that day. Amazon.
God.
Amazon.
Yeah.
So it was pretty profound, and the tools that he taught me in 1984 I'm still using, and the tools I learned from sociology I'm still using.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned something about Tom Ridge, you know, writing you that letter a long time ago. You got him to sign it. Of all the people, and I know there's probably many, of all the people that you've interfaced with over the years, who has had the most profound effect on you in terms of this person modeling some sort of behavior for you that impacts you to this very minute? It could be business, it could be social, whatever the situation is. What local Erieite always comes to mind when you say, you know, I want to be the best that I can be, and this person kind of brings that thought to bear in my mind? Who was that?
My mom. There's just no, I mean, my mother was so profound, and, you know, we lost her in 2012, so it's, you know, 10 years now, over 10 years. But she knew how to bridge all the worlds that we were in. She's the one who introduced me to Lulu Crosby, right? She's the one who made us do volunteer work when we didn't want to.
Oh, okay.
Get out of bed and you're going to come help us do this, or you're going to do that. She's the one who had an open mind to every idea and every policy and every thought. And she's the one who didn't let our minds get jaded, you know, and did, you know. But she also was the person who continually told me I could do anything I wanted. Like, there's nothing that can hold you back. The only thing that holds you back is yourself.
Right.
You know, and, you know, over the years, there's a lot of people. I remember a conversation I have with a guy who was pretty influential in my life as well. And I was going into a meeting, talk about weird meetings. He said, your career is on the line with this meeting. I looked at him square in the eye with my mother's, like, you know, in my mind. And I said, okay, maybe my job is on the line with this meeting, but none of you will define my career.
There you go.
You know, my career will be defined by a body of work, not one meeting. So that's the easiest answer to all the questions. That she was a remarkable woman, a fabulous woman who, courage and strength and wisdom and wit and everything mixed into one. I have four older brothers, the five of us. And we had a great dad. Don't take nothing away from our dad. We, you know, we were very lucky the way we were raised. But the five of us talk constantly of where we are in our careers. My brothers are very accomplished in their careers. Without our mom, we'd melt, you know?
So last question, you've got college Boo Haggerty. And you have the Boo Haggerty that sits before me right now.
Yeah.
Your worldview has changed in what ways? What the most profound way that your worldview has changed from that Boo to this one is what, and how did it get there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it got there by adopting children. Our youngest is adopted from Guatemala. And, you know, granted, this is, you know, 15 years ago. And, you know, who I was then was a little bit different than who I was in college, and who I am now is massively different. Mm-hmm. Marcus, it's a quick story. I'll try to be brief. My wife and I were in Guatemala, and we adopted our son Alex from Guatemala, and we were in Guatemala City, and for those 5 days that we were there, and we had four trips actually before we could bring him home. But that on that last trip, I saw abject poverty, you know, at its worst. You couldn't walk into a store without someone standing at the door, an armed guard, you know, like with a firearm, walking into a McDonald's. Like everything, every corner you looked, there was armed guards, because crime was everywhere. And I thought, this is really poverty in its worst, and in a regime that, you know, I couldn't live in. Couple weeks later, I get back to the States, and we're adjusting to new life with our son. And we had five. He was our youngest at the time. Thinking we got it all, right? We're pretty lucky. You know, we're living in Mill Creek, got a nice house. My kids are all doing well. I got this, you know, new young guy that I was able to adopt. And I had a meeting with Diane Sutton, the principal at Wayne School. Mm-hmm. First time I'd walked into Wayne School, and Marcus, quite frankly and ashamedly, you know, didn't get across the Bayfront High very often. Mm-hmm. You know, and I walked into Wayne, I looked up and down, I looked at these kids, I heard the stories of what they were living in, and I'm like, okay, fine, we don't have armed guards at the door, but we're not much better than what I just saw.
Yeah.
So I saw abject poverty 5 blocks from where I worked that my eyes weren't open to, mm-hmm. until I had this experience. And that was my aha moment, and that's when at least my world changed, to say, I am going to do everything I can as a human being, as an individual, with my job, but also with my personal life, to try to do better, to try to help people that, you know, need that hand up, you mm-hmm. know. And you know the story from here.
Yeah.
We're on a board together, and we bought the school, right? Yeah, you and I were on that board, and we bought that school, and we fixed it up into ECAT and what it is now today. And it has made my life so much better, because the people I've met on this mm-hmm. journey are amazing and incredible. Mm. And I'd much rather hang out at Wayne School than I would any country club in town, because I'm seeing things that I'm watching lives changing before my very eyes. Mm-hmm. It just makes me feel great.
So I want to seize on that for just a second. So this adopted child is obviously a child of color.
He's Mexican.
Okay.
That's not Mexican. Central American is where he's from. Yeah.
Got it. So this is something that I notice about you. I know people that have adopted children from different ethnic and racial mm-hmm. backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And this is no shade on these type of people, but normally it comes up from them fairly often, mm-hmm. especially when race comes up. Well, I've adopted a child of color. I've adopted a child of, you know, cultural mm-hmm. background, blah, blah, blah. You don't do that.
No.
And so for me, it often strikes me, it makes me say, is this for credibility purposes? And appreciate the fact that you've adopted this child, but is this like a street cred thing? Because you bring it up a lot. You never bring up the ethnicity or the ethnic background
yeah.
of one of your children. What is that about? To me, it screams genuine. But what is that about?
Well, first of all, I'm a total idiot, because he's Hispanic.
Yeah,
gotcha. I didn't even get the right race.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because
if you're going to cancel somebody, cancel me over there.
Well, the funny thing is, like, I just see him as my son.
Exactly.
I don't know, Mark. It's just, you know, people ask me before, and it's an honest answer, why didn't you adopt domestically, you know, instead of adopting internationally?
Yeah.
And the answer is, I was too old. I was 45 at the time,
mm-hmm.
and there's different rules about, and my wife and I had not been married very long. So domestically, you have to be married a certain amount of time.
I didn't know that.
And I'm not saying that we wouldn't have adopted domestically as well, but the color of the skin, the gender, none of that meant anything to my wife and I. Although I do have to say, for very personal reasons I won't go into, for my wife, she really wanted a boy.
Got
we
it.
Had a boy, we had three girls. She really wanted a boy mm-hmm. as a bookend. But I don't know. He's just my Alex, man. He's nice. Just my guy, you know?
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, Boo Haggerty, listen, thank you for letting us peek the, you know, peek behind the curtain a little bit.
I loved it.
And see
thank
what's
you.
Behind there yeah. and everything and showing us a different side of yourself. And now I feel like we know a little bit better who you are. So thank you. Thank you all for listening. This is Marcus for Next on WQLN. We'll see you next time.